This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to the Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. I'm Melissa Idris with Tan Chung Han and Kusu Chuang this morning, 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 23rd of March. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning.
All right. Well, unfortunately, I have to start with some bad news. Let's talk about what happened last night. Overnight, there's been breaking news about the terrorist attack in the UK Parliament. 4 dead in this terrorist attack. What happened was a suspected terrorist ploughed a car into pedestrians on London's Westminster Bridge on Wednesday afternoon their time, and he fatally stabbed a police officer before being shot and killed himself. 4 people, including the attacker, were killed, including the police officer, and 20 others injured in this terrorist attack.
Yeah, the news has it that the man in his 40s was described, well, in his mid-40s, and Asian as well. He was shot, but I think he survived, so he's actually in the...
Oh, did he survive?
No. Well, he initially was with the ambulance, but on the way to the hospital, he passed away.
So we've got 4 dead, including the attacker and the policeman that he stabbed to death. And what's, I think, also really... You know, we have to pay attention to what's happened was because this was the exact 1-year anniversary of that attack in Brussels.
That's right.
Yep, the terrorist bombings in Brussels killed 32 people.
Right. No, and when you see these kind of tragic episodes, right, look, this certainly feeds into the overall worldview, if I may say, you know, of those who actually voted for Brexit, you know, as they, you know, try to, you know, limit or stem these kind of instances that are happening within the UK. You see what happened in Nice, Brussels, like you mentioned earlier, you know, and I'm sure it'll also fuel concerns over German Chancellor Angela Merkel's push for, you know, a broader immigration, right?
But we don't know what the motive is,
sure,
whether it was politically or religiously motivated, right?
Sure, but the authorities have labeled it as a terrorist attack. And, you know, it's the border policy that they have in place, right, that at least theoretically can perhaps stem these kind of instances.
I know the bridge quite well, actually. I used to go over there every single day on my way to work, and it's a very busy thoroughfare.
Yep. Is it a tourist attraction as well? Because apparently there were some tourists there.
Kind of, because you can see, you know, you can see the Houses of Parliament right in front of you. You've seen Big Ben and stuff, and you're just on the river, so mm-hmm. It's very, very busy. Lots of people, it's just a sitting target.
Right. So this terrorist ploughed the car into pedestrians, and I think 3 French schoolgirls were also injured in the attack. The House of Commons was in session at the time, and it was immediately suspended. Lawmakers were asked to stay inside. We have reports that Prime Minister Theresa May and Queen Elizabeth are said to be safe and taken away, evacuated for their safety. So we'll keep you updated on any new developments with this case throughout the morning. You can catch it on the Morning Run. We have the news bulletins every half an hour, so we'll keep you updated on this incident. But let's come back to what's happening on the show later this morning. We have 4 hours of interviews and shows, news and analysis. Today on The Breakfast Grill, Julian Ng will be speaking to Robin Lee, the CEO of Hello Gold. Robin is actually has had quite extensive background in the gold, the commodity industry. He was formerly the CFO, the Chief Financial Officer of Spider Gold ETF, as well as the former CFO of the World Gold Council.
Yeah, so I you know, obviously gold is one of those commodities which is a fear asset, essentially, and it's had a bit of a torrid time this last few weeks because of the Trump bump. You know, whenever there's a risk on rally, you know, fear assets like gold tend to get left by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
But what is interesting is that Hello Gold is trying to attack, well, not attack, but trying to penetrate the Asian market, because you can essentially, in theory, you can buy gold assets at very, very low prices. At very low entry prices. I think 10 ringgits per
ticket. Yeah, just a few ringgit, apparently.
Yeah, so it's now accessible to the mass market.
No, but at the same time, I believe this platform seeks to facilitate transactions of physical gold, right? So there is an actual physical asset.
You can take
deliverable.
Physical, but right. You know, most gold, most gold companies like this, they you know, when you can keep it in the trove. So I think there's an is an intermediary that they will sort.
Because the cost of keeping storage for gold is really quite high, isn't it?
But what is interesting about these new models is that you can actually leverage your gold assets and get borrowings on top of that. So now gold is kind of like treated like a currency, and that's the big difference between the past.
Well, I'm really interested to find out a bit more. When you said, Chuang, that they're targeting the ASEAN China market, for instance, I wonder whether in this corner of the world there's a certain reverence towards gold. I mean, we love gold. We love holding on to gold, some kind of tangible wealth asset, right?
Yeah, the old fogies, they want physical gold. But you see, when you talk about the young fellows, people like Han, for example.
Hey!
Yeah, obviously, once you've done your basics, you want to get into gold. And if, in fact, you can actually treat gold as your entry asset point, right? So you can actually, as much as you can afford it, just buy gold and stock up, and you can see your balance rise every month. But for me, because, the characteristics of money are now being displayed in these kind of things, because you can use it, as cash, you can transfer it around, you can leverage it. So it's got all the characteristics of money now.
There you go. All right, more on what gold can bring for you as an investment, as well as I think Gillian will be asking about Bitcoins and the regulatory environment. Hello Gold will be on The Breakfast Grill today with the CEO, Robin Lee. Find out more at 8 o'clock. And after the grill at 8:30 on Current Affairs, we'll check in with the latest on the political situation in South Korea. Earlier this month, Park Geun-hye, the first democratically elected president in South Korea, she was removed from office, the first democratically elected president to have been removed. And now the focus is on the chaebols, the powerful conglomerates in the country. Leaders of chaebols are being investigated for corruption charges, the same corruption charges that brought down President Park. So we want to take a look at what this means for the chaebols. Here's Florian Kolbacher, director of the Economist Corporate Network in North Asia, speaking about the impeachment of Park and how that could hasten the crackdown on chaebols.
I think upholding of the impeachment by the Constitutional Court was a very, very big step forward for South Korea as a country and as a democracy in particular. And I think there are important spillover effects on the economy, and in particular about the issue of the chaebol. Seeing that actually the impeachment of President Park actually happened, that I think gives a tailwind to the prosecutors who are investigating some of the chaebol companies and makes the prospect of actually being able to prosecute them properly more realistic.
That was Florian Kolbacher, director of the Economist Corporate Network in North Asia. And we're going to be taking a look at what will happen to the conglomerates of South Korea and whether Park's political scandal could hasten their downfall. In fact, some believe that the next target could be Samsung, which would be catastrophic to the economy given their contribution to South Korea's economy.
Yeah, I read somewhere that it's something like about 15% of the GDP of South Korea, isn't it?
So find out more on Current Affairs at 8:30 and at 9:30 today on Ringgit and Cents, the show that's all about personal finance. Andrew Stotz, advisor for Fortress Capital, joins us again on the show to discuss how to become a better investor. So details on that at 9:30. But very quickly, guys, let's take a look at some of other news that happened. So apart from the UK terrorist attack, which most of the media has their eyes trained on, we've got back home, the Domestic Trade, Cooperatives and Consumerism Ministry says the weekly retail price of petrol and diesel will be announced now every Wednesday. So it's no longer going to be a monthly system. It's going to be weekly, and it's going to start next Wednesday. So we'll get a new price every week starting the... they're going to set it on the 29th, and then we'll find out on the Thursday.
Yeah, no, I think this is a step closer towards, weaning Malaysian motorists off of this idea of, having this blanket fuel subsidy, and moving towards a more market, market-managed fuel system, right? So, weekly, and then who knows, ultimately maybe daily, and be a completely free floating system. I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Okay, someone has to explain this to me. I understand the floating system of making the prices not just set at a monthly rate, perhaps now going to a weekly rate. But is this a good move, and who is it good for? Is it good for us consumers? Is it good for the petrol dealers? Is it good for the government? Can someone explain?
I think the largest objective here is the country's financial health.
Correct.
Right? I mean, that is the larger, greater good, isn't it? So weaning the country off the country's fuel subsidy mechanism is obviously healthy for the country's balance sheet. It also, I think...
Was the monthly system still subsidized?
Well, it took a long time. You know, obviously, there's a four-week turnaround before you can implement a more live price, right?
So, yeah, okay.
The way that the prices have been jumping all over the place, it gives it much more leeway to have a week-by-week, blow-by-blow.
Volatility,
exactly.
Okay.
Now, I also recall that, recently, a few months ago, when there was a hike in RON 95, at least in terms of the prices at the pump, we had government officials say, I don't know, guess what? It could have been higher if it wasn't for the Prime Minister's directive to keep it lower. So there is still some element of subsidies, at least from what I infer from those statements. But yes, so ultimately, I think it's the government's fiscal, their balance sheet, and also for the retailers of petrol, right?
Well, I'll tell you what, if you have ever existed in a system where fuel prices are matched to the global prices, it is quite painful, okay? So like in Thailand, it's something like 3 ringgit 20 cents for a litre of RON 95. Here, it's 2.30 or so, okay? In the UK, it's probably more expensive than that in Australia as well. So what this does, it weans you off having a private car, it disciplines you to take public transport, it disciplines you to drive less and conserve more. And I think that's also a good thing.
You know, but also at the same time, during my 7 years in the States, you will see how, over there they call it gas prices, right?
When it comes, that's American for you,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, gas prices. So like during the summer when people are going on their road trips, then you see prices really come up. So there's a seasonal effect to it as well.
Oh, so it's like supply and demand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh. And then during the winter it comes down. You know? So I wonder if we'll see those kind of same trends, even though we don't really have those kind of seasons.
Oh, so it's more than just what the current crude oil price is in the global oil price.
Because it affects how petrol dealers buy and store their inventory.
I see. Interesting.
But you see, the thing is, Malaysia as well, we've had it so easy for so long. We've got cheap water, we've got cheap electricity, we've got cheap petrol, and we're so spoiled. So there's a lot of profligacy in the system, right?
Do you foresee any kind of blowback from public opinion? I mean, could this be taken, could there be some backlash
from
this?
For sure.
And so it's not a populist move to do this.
No, not at all.
You go. Okay,
no,
well, let's find out more. Apparently, it's on the papers. It's on the front pages of the papers today. So, well, I guess we'll hear back from how consumer associations will be taking this news. 6:12 right now. After this, Malaysia's obsession with recording world records. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Sweet Jane by The Velvet Underground. Good morning, this is The Morning Run. I'm Sweet Melissa Idris by The Velvet Underground.
Jay, if you don't mind saying so yourself.
One else is going to say it. I might as well say it myself.
We say it all the time. You just don't know it.
Sure, you're not as cool as The Velvet Underground.
Oh.
That was Koo Soo Chong and Tan Chung Han. They're here with me this morning. 6:21 on the clock. Lexus Hibiscus has made it to the Guinness World Records for the most swimming pools in a resort at 643. They've also made it into the world records as the most water villas in a single resort at 522. And this was announced by the tourism minister, Datuk Sri Nazri Aziz. He saw the signing and then there was the plaque and the unveiling of the plaque. So it made us take a look at these world records, right? And how much we love setting world records. We love it. I mean, I've heard everything from like the most people eating the biggest nasi lemak or something.
Do you remember
a few
years ago, the tourism minister in Penang, we had the world's longest barbecue or something, the world's longest buffet table. Remember?
A buffet table.
you know what all this sounds, right? This smacks of insecurity to me, right?
Really?
Well, for sure, because it's like this skinny guy or this puny guy who drives a huge four-wheel drive.
Overcompensating,
is it? It's like an accountant who drives a Harley Davidson.
Is it?
It's trying to compensate for something.
I have to say, though, this is probably... Okay, we Malaysians may have an extra fascination with this, but this is clearly something that around the world... I mean, there was a TV show, for goodness sake, about weird world records being set.
Why don't we have the best IT graduates or the best engineers... Or the most,
the biggest buffet table.
or the most entrepreneurs. Or the most number of listed companies in the Fortune 500.
Right.
Why do we have to fixate on the most... I just want to quote the tourism minister. I must say this is indeed a proud achievement for the resort. For Malaysia to have obtained the accolades from a prestigious institution known for its documentation of record-breaking feats. Well, for the most number of swimming pools?
Look, I don't think this is necessarily a zero-sum game kind of thing. You know?
Don't
like,
you think?
And not as in like, you know, just because we have 643 pools in a resort doesn't mean we can work towards having better education, a better education system and whatnot. I mean, so we'll take it for whatever its value is. I'm sure it means something to some people, and I'm sure the pool maker for that particular resort is laughing his way all the way to the bank. You know, it's like 643, bam, and I'm good, you know. So we take it for its entertainment value, but then at the same time, I don't think we're necessarily not neglecting all the other important aspects of the economy.
I sometimes feel that we're now searching for whatever we can.
Whatever.
So it's no longer
the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah. Well, it's not even low-hanging fruit. It's just, you know, somewhat bizarre because it's no longer the strongest or the tallest or the biggest or the grandest. It's like most swimming pool in a hotel.
Yeah, it's like you send a
it's
guy
a bit
to
obscure.
The you send a guy to the into space and then he makes headlines for making tetare in space. Well, I mean, it's do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well,
you can do a lot more in space.
I have to say
tetare.
Though, you know, I was very proud the day the first Malaysian went to space, but the kind of a backlash we heard from that was a lot of people said that wasn't really space exploration.
It was a paid trip.
It was space tourism.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of the comments that we got back. And, you know, the haters online would come back and say, well, you know, you're just an unpatriotic person. But again, I think it's up for debate. The headlines that made the headlines about that news item was that he made tetare. It wasn't about the first Malaysian in space contributing to science, but rather making tetare.
But look, it's the Malaysian pride which needs something, anything to repair it, right? I remember I was a journalist at the time, right? And in celebration of this trip, the whole of the KLCC conference center, right? Mm-hmm. Massive hall. It's, you know, you can put into, you can put, I think all the entire hall was taken. There was something like 500 tables, all booked out by the government. I'm not sure which ministry did this. Every single table was full of people, food on the table, all the screens on the walls, you know, celebrating this achievement. And people were just tucking, like,
were they serving tetare as well?
it was the most replete buffet I've ever seen.
Okay, it was longest buffet table.
But guys, I mean, can we just not have
I was
have
just wondering who was paying for all this.
Yeah. Right. Well, but can we just not have some fun along the way? Because look, I mean, the kind of resources that it will take to actually produce like the best IT graduates or to produce the first man-made trip to Mars or something, you know, the resources behind it isn't necessarily something that we have, you know, but, you know, having this kind of, you know, fun recognition, you know, let's just take it for what it's worth then just laugh along.
Yeah, you can, but
if times were good, yeah, for sure, but yeah. Times are not good.
I wish we got
more pressing matters.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the attention is being diverted, but also, you know, you want to feel proud about something that's
legit,
that other people can be proud of as well. But, you know, This item also made me pay attention to something I read about Japan. Japan is known to be home to all things weird and wonderful. And they also do, you know, sometimes quirky things that make headlines. But they're celebrated for it. So we're here laughing about the book of records of so many swimming pools in one hotel. But in Japan, there's a new nap cafe that's just opened up. And to worldwide acclaim, apparently people love it. So let me just give a little bit of background as to what this is. This is in Tokyo's Harajuku district, which is known to be the quirky district. It is essentially a collaboration between France Bed and Nescafe. And it's open for a limited time. It has 10 plush beds, and you can go into this bed, take a nap for 2 hours, and then they'll serve you a cup of coffee decaffeinated.
Beforehand. And the normal coffee after.
Yes, and the normal coffee after. But essentially, you go in, take a nap for 2 hours, and then you go out. So it's a nap cafe. But it's gotten so much hype and attention. Why is it that it's okay when Japan does it, but when Malaysia does it, it's weird?
Because there's two crucial distinctions. In the first place, the Japanese tourism minister doesn't come and gush praise all over it. And secondly, it's not the world's longest or biggest or whatever. It's just 10 beds. And the third distinction I just hasten to add is that there's an elements of innovation here. What is innovative about putting a swimming pool in every room?
Well, but at the same time, you know, having this kind of services, you know, is that really necessary? Because I'm thinking it's...
There is some clear market demand in Tokyo, well, because, you know, the Japanese typical salaried employee works, what, 17, 18 hours a day? That fellow needs to sleep.
But also the novelty, yeah, of it, right?
I would go there.
Yeah, yeah, because apparently these beds are said to be plush, and then, you know, you
one
go...
One bed, $9,000.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
Yeah, one
my
bed.
My goodness,
so it's
there you go.
As well.
And then the bed comes with Philips Hue Light and Sony headphones, so you can reach your REM cycle with no interruptions in the 2 hours.
I would actually propose that these guys, you know, roll it out across the world, but put it in offices. I think it'd be great.
BFM needs one of these
for
the morning run crew.
No,
okay?
It's true. Because I remember when I worked in KPMG Sydney, they had a NetPod, which was awesome. You can
what?
There's actually a system online. You could book it. So I would book it for half an hour, and then you go take your naps and during your lunchtime.
Can I just ask, if you worked in Australia, how come you've got an American accent?
So
me.
7.5 years in the States, only 1 year in Sydney.
Wait, let's come back to this nap pod. Yeah. Did people judge you if you took a nap at work?
Nah, that was a long queue, man. Everyone's booking it every single day.
Honestly, Carlton's not doing any work.
What a wonderful idea. So come back, recharge. What was the maximum period that you took?
Half an hour,
Minimum. Nothing.
Yeah. 50 minutes or half an hour.
Judge Dredd. Judge Dredd, there's a sleep machine, 10 minutes and you're off. You got, it's like 9
what
hours.
What is 10
right?
minutes?
Judge Dredd, right?
That's how long you are in the bathroom, Chong.
Correct. That's technology.
That's technology. Okay, we've got the news bulletin, the first news bulletin of the day with Lynn Mark coming up next on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Welcome to the Jungle by Guns N' Roses. Hello and good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run, 6:40 right now with Kusu Chuang, Tan Chung Han and me, Melissa Idris. Now, when it comes to what the five richest men in the world have in common, one of it was really surprising to me. Han, do you want to enlighten us as to what these men have in common?
Yeah, so essentially there's a study done on some of the richest men, and you know, one of the common traits that they all share is that they are all parents. They're all fathers, right? You know, so, for example, even Mark Zuckerberg, he just had his first baby, and they just announced that their second one is on the way. So the idea of this book really was to address this mistaken idea that you have to choose between, say, world-class success and riches versus a happy family life. So the question is this a zero-sum game? You know, are these two pursuits mutually exclusive? So I guess this is something that I know Chuang or anyone can really comment on.
But before we jump into that, the five men that we're referring to, Bill Gates at the top of the list, right? And then we've got Warren Buffett, Jeff Bezos, that Ortega guy.
Ariel Ortega, yeah.
Yep. And then Mark Zuckerberg rounds out the five.
And Carlos Slim himself, you know, has kids as well. So, you know, Chuang being the most authoritative voice on this matter here in the studio, given that you're the only one with kids, you know, I mean, is that true though? Like, are they not mutually exclusive?
Well, yeah, because you see, achievers have this mentality that anything is possible. Okay, so you want to have it all, right? You want to have the kids, the family, the wife, the living home, as well as your commercial success. But I will also add, I want to cite Alex Ferguson here. You know, Alex Ferguson is the Manchester United football manager, retired 3-4 years ago. And in his book, he told the interviewer at the time that he encourages all his footballers to get married as soon as possible, because that gives you a calmness, a stability in your life, which then allows you to focus on the job at hand, i.e. football. So for example, if you're in business, you get married, you sort out your home life, you're not out there per se with a straying mind. So then you can focus on your business or your football.
But then at the same time, doesn't it exponentially add to your responsibilities, you know, what's on your plate, and also a strain on your resources, right? Because as opposed to your money just being spent on yourself, as selfish as that may sound.
Or investing in the business.
Right.
Correct. So the proviso to this, and this is what Alex Ferguson said as well, you must have an understanding and a committed wife. So in his way, in Alex's case, it was his wife, Kathy, who raised the three sons on her own, essentially.
Right.
So you must have a good wife.
I think we're missing this one point. These men were allowed to take some time to focus on their business.
Absolutely.
Because they had a willing and supportive partner.
Absolutely.
Who was taking care of everything behind the scenes. And I think that's also important to point out. I wonder whether women can safely say the same. Women can say, it's okay, we can have it all. We can have the family and the loving relationship and the high-powered career. We want to tell ourselves that. But, you know, when it comes, I'm reminded of, who is that PepsiCo CEO once again? She famously said, you know, she found it was difficult not to have it all. But and the way she dealt with that was by outsourcing it, by having a support group, by having mothers being her mother helping out, having her secretary take care of her kids when she was busy working.
Right. And her name is Indra Nooyi.
Indra Nooyi, yeah. That's right. Thank you.
Yeah. But then also, yeah, you know, you raise a good point, because if you look at the 10 richest people in the world, you know, every year, it's always men, right? So you don't really have women breaking like the ultra super elite, right? Now, granted, according to Forbes' latest list, there have been quite a few women who have become self-made millionaires. For example, the Vietjet founder, you know, when the airline, you know,
fantastic idea, by the way, the bikini airline.
Of course, you would like that, wouldn't you?
But it puts bums on seats, you know. It does.
That and more. Anyways, yeah. So you know, when the airline went became listed, and then she, you know, rose to the ranks.
Her airline is more valuable than the national airline. But I want to say, in Malaysia, right? You've got people like Bridget Lai. You know, people like Zeti Akhtar Aziz, you know, people like, you know, I know a lot of women in this country who have understanding and you know,
supportive partners.
Supportive mm-hmm. husbands. You know, for example, remember the star editor, So Yoo-jin, who I think quite, you know, he passed on some months ago. He very famously once declared that, you know, while his wife is out working, he spent like, I think, 8 years or something as the house husband. That he right. was one who took the kids to school, fed them, you know, taught them their subjects and stuff like that.
Yeah. Now, another interesting thought from this study is that, you know, as opposed to viewing the family as a drain on your resources, and that's the single guy me speaking there. But at the same time, it's also then using your family as an excuse to use them as motivation for actually pursuing those riches. So, you know, I think Chuang, we spoke about this earlier.
You're the provider mentality.
Tell us more about that. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, you want to put your kids through the best schools and put the best food on the table, and you want them to have a, you know, safe and conducive environment. You don't get that by, you know, growing up in the Bronx, for
example,
right?
It's funny, because I feel like for women, there's this, it's a different battle, a different kind of tug of war. You've got the, I want to provide the best for my family, put them through school. But also, when I'm out there in provider mode, I'm depriving them of my care and time and attention. So, you know, it's not just, okay, I'm just going to go earn as much money as I can so they get a better life. Maybe their better life is with me paying attention,
correct,
me being there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I wonder whether men feel the same way. Do they
absolutely.
Have that guilt trip when
you
they're in the
office?
You need
to have that switch where you can say enough is enough. I just want to set a friend of mine, right? His father was the chairman of one of the biggest banks in the country. And I remember I was in my teens. I went to his apartment, beautiful flat in Ampang, right? And when his father came back from work, he had a whole sheaf of documents under his arm, on one arm, and his leather briefcase on the other. He was already in his late 60s by then, chairman of the bank. I'm not going to say which one, right? When I saw my friend greet his father, they shook hands.
Oh, wow.
They shook hands. And it was as if there was this formality between the two of them. And there was no warmth and affection between the two of them.
Wow.
And it was because the father had spent his entire life in banking, grew up as a stranger around his children, and you can tell that there was some kind of formality between the two.
So this is
very sad.
Yeah,
stuck with me till today.
Now this is obviously a very delicate equation, right? Because, you know, on one hand, yes, while you go about in provider mode trying to chase those riches for your kids, at the same time, Melissa, like you pointed out,
right,
you know, you then risk, and it's a very real risk that we see many families enduring. You know, there whereby the relationship between parent and child is then very much strained and distant, right? Handshakes. So yeah, I think it's a delicate balance to strike.
Right.
Can I make one very more important point? Because about a year to this day, in March last year, I went to this camp called Focus on the Family, right? And it's specifically for fathers and sons.
Oh, wow.
Sons between the age of 7 and 13, and they go with their fathers and they spend a night in the jungle and they do all kinds of bonding things together, right? The founder of that camp very, very eloquently told us, the whole room of 35 or 40 fathers at the time, he said, at about the time that your children, and specifically your son in this case, attain the age of 6 or 7 or even 8 years old, that's when they're the most receptive to ideas, to guidance, to all kinds of concepts and philosophies. It is also incidentally, or unfortunately incidentally, the same time as the father is starting to get some seniority in the company, starting his own business, and that's when he's got the least amount of time for the father, for the child. And that 6 or 7 year period is the most crucial for your child's upbringing. And it's also, unfortunately, the time when they spend the most time at work.
Yeah,
and he was. They were trying to rectify that.
That's fantastic, because that was the same thing that Indira, the PepsiCo CEO, also mentioned. She said, you know, when your babies are young, when your kids are young, you're still in the growing phase of your career.
That's right.
But as your kids get older, it's your husband that needs the most attention, because he then becomes a teenager again.
Yeah.
And then as you get older, and when you're in the, you know, you're in the upper management and you're trying to get into a position of leadership, that's when your parents need you the most. So at every phase of your life, you're devoting care and attention to one aspect, one role that you're playing. So again, it's whether you can balance the two. And I wonder whether sometimes we choose to put one on the back seat.
It's a matter of choice.
And it's not just a two. You know, some sociologists even call it like a triple burden. So, you know, women are playing the role of, you know, employee, mother and wife, you know, in many instances, right?
Yeah.
So it's having to find
and daughter as well.
Right. So, but then at least we are seeing some gains, you know, made towards helping women manage those triple burdens. Maybank, for example, announcing their 1 year parental leave.
I thought that was a great move.
Even IKEA India.
IKEA as well.
Yeah. That's right, you know.
Can I just make one very, very important point before we end? Just want to cite this example of a friend of mine works in Jakarta, and one of his best friends works at one of the biggest telcos in the region. He was in his late 30s, heavily overweight. And I remember three of us sat down one night in Bangsam, and he was telling us, because he was actually very, very wealthy by that time, the telco guy, right? He had bought like 4 apartments in Singapore, very well situated in terms of financial means, but he was heavily overweight, and his doctor had said, if you keep on flying everywhere in your career, and you keep on neglecting your health, you've only got 3 more years to live. You know what he said? He said, I'm going to do it. It's okay for me to pass away as long as my kids are well situated financially. And in my mind, I was thinking, but your kids will need you.
Yeah, they need their father.
It's not about the money. It's about you.
Yes,
you see?
That's
so
true. That's a good point.
That's a lesson. That's
a lesson.
Everyone.
Well, tell us what you think. I know it's a struggle that most parents go through every day, you know, trying to balance work with family life. Tell us how you're doing it. At BFM Radio is our Twitter handle. You can WhatsApp us at 016-201-9000. We want to hear how you're doing it. We've got the 7 o'clock news coming up in 10 minutes. But for now, here's Spiderwebs by No Doubt here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.